Blog Talk Radio.
I stroll through the picture, what I've left behind. You once again. I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know just what you have done.
Well, good evening, everyone. This is Kim, and I am on this evening with my co-host, Annie. And we are excited to have a very special guest on this evening, and I will tell you a little bit more about her biography just in a little bit. But first, we've got to do all the housekeeping stuff. So here at NASCA, we have a single purpose, and that is to address issues that are related to childhood abuse and trauma, including sexual assault, violent or physical abuse, emotional traumas, and neglect, and we do so with only two goals. One, by educating the public, especially as this related to helping society get over its taboo of discussing childhood sexual abuse, presenting facts showing child abuse to be a pandemic worldwide problem that affects everyone, and two, by offering hope and healing through numerous paths, providing many services to adult survivors of child abuse and information for anyone interested in the many issues involving prevention, intervention, and recovery. And we are on scan number 3001 this evening. And our special guest tonight is Nadine, a beautiful woman. We've been just chatting on the other line here a little bit before we went online, and I feel like we are friends already. And I just love that. She's from Oxford. I said it wrong. From California, and a survivor of child abuse and a new NASCA member. So we're welcome. We're so excited to have her. She's a wife and a homemaker and a mom of two children, a 14-year-old daughter and 10-year-old son who has Down syndrome. And she says that she's been in recovery from mental health and addiction issues since 2005. But she struggled on and off for most of those years to stay clean and gain some continuous clean time, she says. She found her recovery. She found that her recovery, that struggling with childhood trauma and of losing her father at the age of 9. She was abused by a relative and a respected adult in her life by the age of 12. She goes on to explain that from that point on, I lived in survival mode until I found escape in drugs. She found this 12-step program, she said, in recovery, and Nadine began to work on herself to heal her mental health from the addiction issues. She says she's come a long way in her recovery, learning to reparent herself and her children in more healthier ways, and she works on a program of recovery. She goes to mental health groups and volunteers in the community where she's able. And she just goes on to say that she knows how important it is that she has a strong faith in God and Jesus Christ, and she tries to live the best life that she can according to his will and by following a program of recovery. So we are just, you know, so honored to have her on this evening. If you would like to call in and be on our panel, we would love to have you. The guest call in this evening is 646-595-2118. And again, we are on scan number 3001. So I'm going to go ahead and bring Nadine on. Hi, Nadine.
Hello. Hi, everybody. Thank you so much. I'm so honored to be here. Thank you for having me.
We are honored to have you. Yeah, now, Nadine had told me in the beginning, and so I'm just going to put this, you know, to our audience as well, that she has two children at home right now with her husband at work, and so we all know, most of us know how that goes, so we can all just respect that you might have to yell at somebody at some point, or I'm just kidding. Or just say something. Yeah, so we are so excited to have you on this evening. Thank you. Sorry, I botched up your state name, even though we talked about it before we went on the air, but you know, things will happen as soon as you get up
there. It's ox, yeah, nard, like ox, like an ox animal, and nard.
And it does look like it sounds, so, you know, it was just, yeah, just me, just the deliverer.
No
so
problem.
Go ahead go ahead.
No, I was going to say, we're just a little beach town. We used to, like all the Hollywood people, celebrities used to come up to Oxnard back in the day. It was a little more glamorous than it is today. It's not so glamorous anymore, but I love it here.
You don't get so many of the rich and famous anymore, huh?
I mean, we have our share. We have a couple, you know, really nice neighborhoods in the county and in Ventura and some in Oxnard, but we're mostly fields here and beaches, fields and beaches, and two Navy bases. So
no.
I mean, we're a big community, but it's like you kind of know everybody, too.
That's nice.
Really nice.
And you've been raising your children there?
We moved here before I gave birth to my second son. My daughter was about 3, and we've lived here since 2011. So this is where we laid down our roots. My mother was ailing and getting older, so I wanted to be close to her. I moved a mile less away from her. My children got to have her in their lives. So.
Oh, that's great.
I really
it's
love
so
where
great.
I live. Being close to the beach is so nice.
Yeah. Yeah. And having grandma around is the best, too, you know, for as long as you can have her around. I had grandparents, and so they were a great example of how I'm now grandparenting my grandkids. And so it's a lot of fun. But
I'm enjoying it.
No, I was just going to say, go ahead and start wherever you'd like to start, if you want to start from, you know, the time that you can remember, or if you wanted to start a little bit, just go ahead and tell us a little bit about your story.
Okay. Well, first of all, I want to say, like, there's not a tremendous amount of abuse in my history, but there's some sexual abuse and there's some emotional abandonment. There's a lot of trauma and a little neglect, you know, and I love my parents. I don't blame them for anything. They were World War II survivors. My dad was in the Army. My mom was in Germany. They had 2 kids before he brought her over. He did bring her over. She was lucky. And they're a little older than most of the parents that I grew up with. And, you know, they did their best. They were hardworking people. And they did their best, and I came from a big family. I'm a baby of 7. I have 3 brothers and 3 sisters. And we're 5 different generations in our family. So I grew up as a baby of 7, but I kind of grew up alone, like an only child in bits and pieces. And I want to say, I think it's important to say that my mom and dad, when I was a little girl, real little, probably, you know, I think at the age of 6 is when we left this their type of work. But my mom and dad owned a tavern in Chicago. And I grew up in the tavern. I grew up in the tavern, and, you know, only from being in bars myself and knowing what goes on in a bar, I can only imagine the things I saw, but I don't remember seeing things. But I can imagine I probably endured some things there, but nothing I can remember. I remember everyone was really good to me. They showed me how to play pool, and I liked all the regulars knew me and liked me, and I was, you know, I was a special little girl to everybody. My mom and dad moved to California in 79. They bought into a business with my sister and her husband, I believe a jewelry store or something like that, downtown Los Angeles, and we lived in Glendale. And soon after we moved here, my dad passed, and a lot of my childhood I don't remember, but there's certain things I remember, and most of what I remember about my childhood is that I was very close to my dad. I think I was a daddy's girl, but I don't know. My sisters and brothers told me that I was a daddy's girl, that I remember catching fireflies with my father, and he would take all the neighbor kids out in our motorhome and go get ice cream, and those were such good memories for me. And when my mom and dad separated, when my dad passed, so it was already kind of a traumatic issue, my dad being out of the house. They were planning to divorce. And when he died, my brothers and sisters, several, the ones that lived in California with us, is, I think my brother and my two sisters, and then some of my sister's in-laws came with her to tell me. I was alone in the apartment where we lived. I was a latchkey kid. Again, I was 9 years old at the time. And they came to tell me that my father died. He was driving a car. He had a heart attack, and he pulled off the side of the road and, I guess, passed. And they said that the look on my face, that something in me changed. And I would say if I had something in my life that changed, it was that. I was not ever the same. I don't know who I was before that, and still trying to find out who I am after that. It's been a lifelong process. That was a great, tremendous trauma to me. I would have dreams, you know, that my mother would be dating a man that looked like my father, but only I knew it wasn't my father, and I would try to convince everybody that this man wasn't my father, and they were nightmares and things like this, and I was just very traumatized. And when I went back to school, I remember crying, and the kids made fun of me because I was crying, and I had, you know, stuff coming out of my nose, and I didn't have a nap yet. I didn't know what to do. I was just beside myself. I was in fifth grade. And my dad's passing was so tragic to me. It was tragic to everybody in my family. He was our leader, and we all loved him dearly. There was a bit of domestic violence in my family that I witnessed as a young child. I remember my sister taking me in the room and hearing dishes breaking and yelling and screaming. And I never knew that did anything. You know, I never knew. I just thought that was normal until, you know, I became a parent. And our form of communication was yelling and grabbing and being sort of abrasive. And it just wasn't, I didn't like the way I was feeling as a parent. And I know that a lot of what I endured as a child, like I remember my mom brushing my hair, and I love my mom to death. You know, I don't want to say a bad thing about her, but she suffered with depression, untreated, undiagnosed depression. Now, I can't say what she had for sure, but, you know, a lot of her behaviors and things I learned from her. But my mom had seven kids, you know, five different sort of family, generational families within those seven kids. And I think by the age of 40 when she had me, she was pretty tired, you know. She was pretty tired.
Yeah.
And she was older. And it's not, you know, I know from experience, too, it's not easy being an older parent. I had my son at 42, and he's now 10. And it's hard, but they keep me young and active. And I think my mom would get frustrated with me getting me ready for school, and she had to work herself. And I think at the time my dad may have been a truck driver and out on the road. This was before they had the bar. And, you know, she would brush my hair, and she would kind of knock my head up on the fridge, you know, and I would just be in total tears, you know. And that was a little bit of abuse that I endured. My mom was a little physical. My grandmother, God bless her, she was a little physical. You know, it was just in the 1970s, that's what it was. That's all I knew. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know if other, you know, I don't know. It was very different back then. We got the wooden spoon. And I learned, I think, at a very young age, not to be a bother, to just kind of blend into the woodwork, don't make a fuss. If I need something, I better be really sure that's what I needed, and asking and bothering people, adults like. So it wasn't a bad childhood per se as far as that abuse goes, but I do realize came to parent my children. I didn't know how to parent other than that. And that to me was horrifying. And I was not going to allow myself to continue to do that. So I'll get more into that. But just moving along, when my dad died, you know, my dad's sister and her husband came, and they kind of consoled me and told me, you know, how it was going to be for me without a dad, and that they would, you know, they didn't live close, but they would always try to be there for me and my mom. And it was really hard on my mom. You know, she had to go back to work full time. You know, she had lost the store or the jewelry store they were working at, or it changed hands or something like that. And she had to get a full-time job. So my mom was not in the home. My mom lost the love of her life, the father of her 7 children. You know, they had been married 30-something years, 34 years when he died. I might be wrong about that, but they had been married a long time. And, you know, she kind of just normally, like any normal person would do, she checked out emotionally. You know, my mom was working, not available. You know, she was busy. She wasn't home. And my older sister, she also worked, and she took care of me a lot. And, you know, she did a lot of wonderful things for me, my sister, in my life. She took me to church when she and her husband and started having a family, and I would go to church with them, and I would go to dinners with them, and I would go on vacations with them. You know, she was very good to me, my sister. You know, but, you know, she wasn't my mother. You know, she was a young woman. She was, you know, in her mid-20s at the time, and when I was about 9, she was in her mid-20s, I believe, and, you know, she was dating. She was marital clock was ticking. She wanted to get married and have her own kids and get out of the house with my mom, you know, but she was happy, but she had me, you know. I was a burden. I really knew I was a burden on my family. I was born when my mom and dad were separated, and I was kind of like, I think my mom's ploy to like get my dad to come back home, which he did quite a bit. He was a womanizer, and I think that I must have, I maybe saw that, because I know a lot of that came out in my own experience, the stepping out of my marriage, having, you know, several, you know, being quite promiscuous and just doing pretty much whatever, you know, and being in survival mode for such a long time. I just did what I wanted. You know, once I graduated school, I got a job, I got an apartment, you know, at 19. You know, I was on my own from 19 to when I met my husband at like 37. But, when my dad died, my aunt and uncle were trying to kind of console me, and it was just very hard for me. I was really, I had gotten a male teacher for the next grade, and I insisted that I not have a male teacher. I couldn't deal with it. I think I was not diagnosed until I was 19 with my mental health issues, so I think they were dealing with that as well. You know, my mom did her best to give in to me a lot so that she could deal with her guilt, because she knew she wasn't there for me like she wanted to be. And I believe that, you know, like she really, my mom felt really guilty about me. She always felt very guilty about me. I don't know why, but I'm thinking because my dad died and she felt responsible. She felt somewhat responsible, you know, that they had me so late, or, you know, that I didn't have, she felt really bad I didn't have a father. And it was traumatic. It was traumatic for me not having a father. When my dad died, I ballooned up to like, oh, I can't really even say, but I'm probably over 100 pounds at the age of nine, you know, and that's a lot. I got really heavy. I didn't want to be seen. This is me now looking back at that time. Like I didn't want to deal with life, and I ate. That was my first addiction. I ate, and I would go to the market with my best friend when she would spend the night, and we would just go out and we would just buy all kinds of food, junk food, and we would just binge. And I got real heavy, and most of the people that were mean to me about my weight were the people in my family. That's where I got a lot of negativity and abuse and self-esteem issues. You know, it was my family or family, friends that would say things like, you shouldn't be eating too much sugar, or you shouldn't be eating that. And my mom, you know, would try to tell me, but like I said, my mom felt so guilty about our position in life and her being so low income, and she really struggled to take care of me. You know, she was living on my dad's Social Security survivor insurance. And, you know, I grew up, I did pretty well. I stayed out of trouble. You know, maybe I got stopped once by the cops when I was a kid and I had a joint on me. I was really scared, and they didn't do anything or check us or anything. They let us go. You know, and that's probably like the worst, you know, I never went to jail as a kid. When you cross the street, the jaywalking ticket, we had to go to court. You know, that was like the worst. That was like the worst I really did. And so I was basically a pretty good kid. I stayed out of trouble. There were no gangs where I lived. You know, it was a predominantly upper class white neighborhood. You know, I lived in an apartment. We were very low income. Like I said, my mom struggled to pay rent for us and have an apartment. When I turned 18, I was expected to go. I was expected to take care of myself. And I did get a job at 16, and I worked for a dentist, and I had a little bit of money for myself to go out and do. I liked to go dancing when I was a kid. And then I got into drinking about 17 really bad with my friends. You know, we were kind of the outcast sort of crowd. We didn't roll with the popular kids, but we weren't stoners, you know. We were just, but nobody really bothered us. And we had our good friend circle. But we did smoke a little. I think I started smoking pot at 15 was the first time I tried smoking marijuana, and I liked it. I think I liked drinking was more accessible to us. But we would get mean. We would drink, and then we would order pizza, and then we would like verbally berate the pizza driver. It was just awful what the drinking did. And luckily we grew out of that. We grew out of that quickly. And like I said, after high school, I wasn't enrolled in college, but I had to go to work. I had to quit college, and I had to go to work to support myself. My mom, when I turned 18, lost my dad's survivor, Social Security, and I became my sole guardian, you know, at 18, you know. My mom moved in with my brother. I was not welcome there. Finally, they did let me come. It was such a bad situation. My sister-in-law, you know, they were newly married. They just had, you know, it's just a, it's a bad situation for everybody. But they were, you know, they weren't always nice about it, you know, and we felt really like we knew we were imposing, and we were just, I think my mom said that there were times that my company saved her from, you know, taking herself out. She was so depressed. And I never felt at this time the kind of depression that I later felt in life, but I didn't really want to not live, so I was just living, and I was kind of in survival mode, and I was excited to be working, and when I got money to get my own place, and I was living with my brother-in-law and my sister at the time, and my mom with my sister and brother-in-law in their home and their kids. We lived in the living room, and my sister said, now you have some money. I got like a tax return. She said, now you have some money. Get a place. You have a job. So I got my own apartment. My mom always helped me with, you know, any odds or ends I needed, or bought me housewares and things, good to me as I got older. And I was real heavy. I didn't have a boyfriend or anything. You know, when I turned 19 and I was working in a fast food restaurant as a manager in training, I started fooling around with the guys. You know, they would ask me out, and I just started becoming very promiscuous. You know, I didn't have a boyfriend. I was just messing around sexually and experimenting and having, I guess, a good time at the time. My sister did bring me into, you know, I grew up as a Catholic, and my sister did invite me to a Christian church or a non-denominational church, where I did find the Lord, and you know, I think a lot of people say I am a very religious person. I've had God with me all the time. I can't imagine what would have happened to my story, what my story would be without God having been present with me and shielding me and covering me and leading me from danger and whatnot. But let me see. I forgot where it was now. I'm sorry. So when I got my own apartment, I was working like full time. You know, I worked in a restaurant. I was a manager in training. So I worked whenever they told me. They said, you want to cover this shift? Yes. You know, I needed the money. I needed to work. But, you know, I was doing well with my finances. I was surviving. I was doing good. I didn't have time really for drugs and alcohol. I was just, or substances, you know, I was working, and I was a responsible adult, and I was taking on my new role very proudly, and I had a sense of pride about it. You know, I was the only person my age that had an apartment, but zero. Mm-hmm. So, and making as much money as I was, you know, and it was really great. I was really fortunate that I was able to work and join the workforce and get good jobs. And I had good people around me that would, you know, recommend me, you know, and, so I had this good job in a fast food restaurant, and I was becoming a manager slowly but surely. I worked my way up as a drive-thru cashier into the manager in training position. I became an assistant manager. I worked several years at that. And I would drink socially and whatnot. And, you know, and then I had some bumps in the road. You know, I did get married at 19 to a man I was working with at the restaurant. He was the night porter. They would lock him in the restaurant at night, and he was clean, which is a weird job. But, and then in the morning they would let him out, but we ended up getting married. He was undocumented. He was a Mexican undocumented person, and you know, I really wanted him. We were in love, and I don't have a doubt that he did love and care for me. At the time, it wasn't like a paper situation, but I always felt like, is he with me for my papers? Or people thought that or whatnot. But No, you know, he never even got his papers. We were not able to do it, you know, by the time we broke up. And I even said to him, you know, go get your papers. But he never did. And we broke up in 94 after the big earthquake in California, which was very close. The epicenter was very close to my house. And that brought on a lot of trauma. And that's when I got diagnosed with bipolar disorder 1. I am on disability. So my work that I do is my recovery right now. That's my full-time job. And my husband luckily helps me with the kids, and he takes a lot of responsibility of the kids onto him. So he's very supportive. But, you know, when they had the earthquake, I had kind of like a setback, and my husband and I were breaking up because he had cheated on me and he got another woman pregnant. And at the time, I couldn't get pregnant, and they diagnosed me infertile, even though they put me through the treatments and everything, but it was unsuccessful. So when he left me for this woman, he got pregnant, I was devastated. I tried to kill myself for, I think it was the second time. I think when I was a teenager, I tried to take, like, Tylenol or something. I didn't know what I was doing. But this time I took, I don't know what I took, but I took something that I knew. I was already on mental health medication, so I took something that was to sleep, and I took a lot of it, and I ended up going to the hospital and having to get not my stomach pumped. And then I began, from that point on, when we broke up in our first marriage, you know, I began going into the mental hospital a lot. You know, I was losing it. I was not stable, and that lasted for about 7 years. I had to get back up on my feet and do meals, you know, low entry level jobs. You know, I didn't have an education as far as college. You know, I just had my work experience, which was really good. It helped me to get some higher paying jobs, you know, where I could afford my rent. And, you know, I finally got back on my feet. My brother-in-law got me a job in the insurance industry. I worked really well. I was a workaholic. I would work so much. And again, I was very heavy now at the time. In my working days, I was at the top weight, I was at 297. And I was working
you
at
haven't
a
had
late
kids.
Age. I hadn't had my kids yet. I was in my late 20s. Yeah. And they told me I was infertile. I was not going to have children. And, you know, I was devastated. I was devastated by that. I was devastated by the marriage. I was devastated by my husband leaving me. It was just, it was total devastation, disappointment. You know, these are the times when I just didn't want to live. I didn't have a reason. I didn't feel I had a reason to live, you know. I had friends, but that was really it. And my mom, and that was really it. My family, you know, always kind of, they love me because I'm their family, but they really would rather not have anything to do with me. You know, I've just always been a lot of trouble. And that's kind of how they see me, I think. You know, it's just they can't put their head around me. And they do their best, but they just really rather not deal with me, I think. So when I had gastric bypass, I'm sorry?
I said, God doesn't think that about you. That's a good thing.
Yeah.
Hey,
so
you
when
know,
I had gastric bypass surgery. Hello?
Maybe?
Hi.
Yeah, I was
kidding. This is cool. How are you?
Hi, Bill. I'm good. How are you?
I just wanted to thank you for being here, and I want to especially thank him for taking the show this far. But now there are two more of us here, and I wanted to make you aware of it, okay? So there's myself, and there's also Annie. Annie, say hi to Nadine, please.
Hi.
Hi, Annie. How are you? Happy Labor Day, everybody.
Thank you very much.
Happy Labor Day.
So I want the other people that are out there to know that I've been in communication with you. You took a slot that we were having a problem filling, which is today's slot, today's show. And we kind of hurried up and got you on the air and stuff like that. I didn't have time to even let Kim know who you were. So anyway, this is a gal who's telling her story with us for the first time. And we've been in recovery a little while. She's told her story before to others, but not to us. In fact, have you ever been on the radio before? I don't think so.
Only to win a prize.
Only
and
to win
I've
a
never
prize,
really
right.
told my story in this amount of length of time and
I,
had,
that's
you know,
what I mean.
Such. Yeah, so I'm kind of probably all over the place. I apologize.
No, you're doing fine. I think she's doing fine. Kim, you are doing a great job, and we want to thank you, Annie and I, for holding down the fort till we got here. Now, Nadine has the opportunity to tell her story tonight, and it's going to be Kim's job, basically, Nadine, to direct you in terms of how much time you should spend on each part of it, because we want to make sure you get it all on the air. Okay. You'll be surprised when the time runs out, because it goes very quickly. And at first you think it's going to take forever, but it just zips by. So I'll let you go, Kim. I'm going to stay here with the show now, of course, but I just wanted to identify that Annie and I both were here, Maureen, and thank you and Kim both for holding the fort down until we did get here, okay?
Thanks, Phil.
Thank you so much for having me, too.
It's our privilege, of course, right, Kim?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's been an honor listening to your story. And so I thought maybe I would ask Annie if she had a question or anything that she wanted to ask so far.
You know, I've only been on for a minute, and so I don't have a question yet. Give me a few more minutes. Thank you.
Oh, absolutely.
Sure.
Absolutely. Well, yeah, so I know that you had talked also a little bit in your bio, Nadine, about being sexually abused as a child. And was
I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. I was just curious if you wanted to share that part. Or if,
I will.
You know, sometimes it hurts. Yeah. Because I could see how that would happen. I know that that's okay. I lost my biological dad as well when I was 12. But, however, I wasn't as close to him as you were. He was already pretty much out of our lives by that point, and I had a stepdad that had been around for many years, but he was abusive. So I kind of know how that goes. I just remember that feeling, and like I said, I wasn't as close as it sounds like you were to your dad, but I do remember that feeling of I'm never going to have this opportunity now to know him any better. And then I think especially as I got into adulthood, I started to think, wow, it would have been cool to know him as an adult, you know, since I didn't know him so much as a child. And so I think I felt like I lost that part of him, you know?
Yeah.
Do you ever remember kind
of
feeling?
Honestly, the feeling I had more is that had my dad lived financially and opportunistically, I would have had such a different life. But and that was back in the day, you know, I was kind of like mad, like, hey, you left us. We barely have a place to live. We barely put food on the table, you know. I was working since 15, you know. And I just, poor me, woe is me. And I became a victim. I became a victim of my circumstances. And I had to work through that. It took a long time.
Yeah.
So going back to the sexual abuse after my dad had died, this relative of mine who was earlier consoling me about how my life would be without my dad and they would be there for me. And they were at our house. They came for a visit down from Northern California. And the male relative went into the bathroom and my room to change. That's where they were staying, in my room. I don't know why I happened. The bathroom and my room were connected. So I think I went to the bathroom and I happened to see him And he showed himself to me nude. And this was my relative, and I was, you know, I was 12, so, like, I wasn't oblivious. I knew exactly what was going on, and I just turned around and walked out. Then that same day, we happened to go from our house in Glendale to visit my sister in North Hollywood and take a car ride. And back in those days, you didn't wear seatbelts, and it was me, it was my mom, it was my other relative, his wife, and my sister, and we were all in the Monte Carlo, and he sat in the front, my mom drove, and I sat between his legs. And in front of my mother, his wife, and my sister, the man felt my breath, you know, my torso, kind of dug in to my stomach area a little bit and tried to go further, but it wasn't that long of a ride, thank God, you know, and that was basically the amount of abuse sexually that happened to me. I never thought it was bad. I just lived with it and I went on. But this man, the way that he did it, it embarrassed me, you know, like my mom, I couldn't say anything, you know, I couldn't say stop because his wife was there, my mother was there, you know, I would be found out. And, you know, as a child, you somehow have this responsibility. And the responsibility that it carried with me is that he was a pastor and he went to Mexico a lot and he worked with orphanages and he worked with children. And I don't, you know, in my mind, I honestly don't know if there were other victims, but the way that I'm he assaulted sure. that day was so brazen and so just in front of everybody that my caretakers, you know, he did it right in front of them. So he had, to me, now as, you know, with the maturity I have, I see that he must have been a very seasoned pedophile.
Yeah.
And I was very lucky.
Sounds like it.
And I carried that with me for 30, 40 years, you know, that were there other children out there? He works with kids. I can't say anything. I can't help them. I need to help, you know, I'm really responsible for them. And I do to this day, I feel like, you know, I wanted to tell people his name so they'll know if they were abused, you know, but I tried to, you know, get a hold of the authorities. And I think time is, you know, I didn't want any kind of, he's dead and gone, but I know there were kids that were hurt. I really think there were other children that were hurt by him. And that just hurts my soul, you know.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
That was the extent of my abuse. And it's nothing, you know, compared to what I've heard so many people go through. And I was very fortunate.
But we don't compare. We really don't.
We don't compare, but that's where I say it wasn't tremendous amount of abuse in my past, but more so trauma.
Yeah, but, well, you know what, when you were smoking pot at a young age, I mean, that was you reaching out and trying to get, I mean, you were trying to say, there's something not right here, and looking for something else. I mean, you knew that something wasn't right in your family, you know, even before your dad passed away. I mean, kids feel know that feeling. Right.
Yeah,
you don't know, but you know it's not right. And then, you know, pedophiles, like you were saying, he had to been very seasoned, because he's so brazen, and that's the way they are. I mean, they, you know, groom, now that, I mean, you probably know a lot more about it now, too, but they do. They groom not only the child, but the whole family. And so he had this reputation within the whole family of being a nice guy. And so that was what allowed him to be so brazen and do those things, because nobody would have ever thought it. And what is, you know, who's going to believe a little, you know, 12-year-old? Who's going to believe him? So, I mean, it,
yeah,
it was,
and I never told anybody until I was like, I never told yeah. anybody. I think my sister was the first person I told, and I was probably in my 30s.
Are you? No. Yeah, no, I'm sorry that that happened, because it is. And also, we don't understand. So my first experience, I was 5. It was a neighborhood kid. And I just knew that I didn't feel as mature. And that's what went through my head at 5 years old. I thought, I'm not mature enough to take this. And so that's why I'm running away from it. So we just don't know. And I think, you know, everything in those ages, in those younger years especially, is new. Everything is new. So anything that, you know, any kind of abuse that's introduced to us isn't a new thing to us. It's just new like everything else. You know what I mean? So,
yeah,
I mean, we just don't know. We just don't know. And so who gave you the pot when you were younger? Was it friends? Or?
When I was a teenager, it was like an older boy in high school. I think I was 15. I think he was maybe 17. And it was me and some friends. We went to his house. We knew we were going to smoke pot. And, you know, it was a big deal back then. It was a big deal. I remember, you know, we'd do the marijuana. It was always hard to get the marijuana. So drinking was easily accessible because my friend at the time, his parents were heavy drinkers, and we would just raid their cabinet and there would never be a problem.
Yeah, they didn't know. They didn't know anything.
Yeah, and when I was a little girl, my mom always saved the little bottles from the airplane, and she had a collection, and I remember as a child, maybe it was after my dad died, so maybe 9 or 10, I would play bar with the neighborhood kids, and we'd drink, you know, and I did that, you know, and I served them all the bar drinks and, you know, things like that. And,
right.
You know, and I started being sexually active at a very young age, you know, as far as inquisitive and experimenting and things like that. And, you know, a lot of things I did as a child, I think back and I say, wow, I was how old doing that? And
right.
with the people was I was older. Doing it with, and they were how old? And I hope I wasn't the instigator, you know, at the time. I don't think I was. I've never been the real big instigator, but I'll go along, you know. But
right.
I have a lot of guilt
fun.
About that.
Oh,
well, it was
no
fun. When I think about how old I was, it was just not, and it was just too inappropriate. It was too young. It was too young.
Yeah.
Too young for me. It was too young for everybody.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I was going to say, there's somebody that just came on, and then they raised their hand. So I was going to see if it's okay if we go ahead and bring them on and see who it is and see if they have a question for you. Is that okay? Okay.
Let's
see who it is. They've got an 805 area code. So hold on. So maybe it's somebody you know.
Leon?
Hi. Hi. This is Kim. You're on live. What are we speaking to?
Yeah, hi. Did you disconnect me?
Oh, what's that?
Oh, can you hear me?
I can hear you. Yeah, you're on live on the radio.
Oh, hi, this is Lane Martinez. I'm out here in Ventura County, and I'm a friend of Maydeen. Maydeen, I just want to say hi, Maydeen. How are you?
Hi, Lane. I'm doing okay. I don't know how it is on your end, but thank you so much, Lane, for referring me. And I dedicate this interview to you, Tanya, because you guys have gone before me, and you're my very good friends in recovery, and I love you both very much. Thank you.
Yeah. You know, if I could say something, hi, Bill. Hi, everybody. You know, I think one of the things that's very important, you know, me and Nadine go way back is talk about what you lost, Nadine, and how you and your husband and the work that you did to get back those two beautiful children. I think that's a story within itself that no matter what, being broken and going to any length to bring back those two beautiful children that you have, I think that's an awesome story as well. And that's something you should share out there. No matter what, the stumbles and coming back and how you got to where you're at today and your husband. And that story is very important for people to know, and it's very important for you to tell, I think.
Thank you, Wayne. Yes, I will.
So she's not gotten up to that point, Lane. We're going to have her tell her story sort of chronologically. That's what Kim's doing.
Yeah.
But she's doing a great job. But I do want to go back just a moment, if I can, in time, because she just told the story about the person that was naked in front of her and then took her in the car and felt her up and stuff like that. And I got to tell you, you know, don't poo-poo that. That's a big deal. And it's a big deal. We don't measure each other's, you know, sexual abuse, but we know that the trauma that occurs is not related so much to the seeing them naked as to how it makes you feel later and how it makes you feel even now. So that's the trauma.
Yeah.
And it's significant.
Yeah.
And people who are abused, they experience, you know, some experience more events or less events and different kinds of events. But if you experience trauma, you experience trauma. So we don't measure that. In other words, it matters to us that you were capable of telling the story, and it matters to the listener. And that's who we talk to about, right? We talk to the newcomer.
Yes, that is.
We want them
to
know that
so much
maybe
more important.
Many people who are out there may be thinking the same way you used to think, that if, you know, the things that happened to them weren't that big, you know. So, but they are big, and so we want to make you feel comfortable in telling it, in telling all of your, any part of your story that you feel appropriate. But on the other hand, we won't press you to tell you things you're not comfortable with either. Kim knows this, so
yeah.
But thanks very much for telling that part of the story. And Lane, thanks for calling in.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Lane, for calling in. I love you. I'm so proud of you. I'm glad you're my friend.
Me too. Me too.
Yeah, so thank you for that. Was there anybody else have any questions? We're kind of in between a little break here. Okay, we can come back. Come back around. So, you were talking then about
I think I've left off with the abuse, and if it's okay, I'll go back to when my addiction actually started with drugs after my gastric bypass. Is that okay?
Yeah, absolutely. That's funny about that.
Okay, so in 2001, I had gastric bypass. It was before it became just right before it took off. I had my surgery August 6, 2001. I was at the top weight of 297. I had sleep apnea. I had my psychiatrist had called me morbidly obese, which made me very morbid.
No.
I was shocked, and the way he spoke of me was so degrading and so alarming that I was so depressed. And then I saw this lady at work. She'd been losing a lot of weight. I said, I don't care what you're doing. Tell me what it is. I'm going to do it too. And she told me, and it was a surgery. And I'd never heard about it but I knew it was for me. And my mom even told me, if you do that surgery, I'm never going to talk to you again. I said, Mom, you'll get over it. This is going to be the best thing that ever happens in my life. And in a way it
good
was.
Good support.
In a way it was. And I lost 145 pounds within 18 months. And I was flabbergasted by all the comments I would get, like, how great you look. And nobody had ever told me such, and it really built my self-esteem up. It really sent me out on being, well, it wasn't very promiscuous. There weren't a lot of suitors, but you know, I changed jobs later on and went to a new office, and I met up with this girl, and this girl introduced me to methamphetamine. And when I was a little girl, I remember being on the car with my sister and we saw like a disheveled woman, and she was on the street just kind of sitting there. I don't know if she was holding a sign, but she could have been holding a sign. And I said to my sister, you know, I must have been 5 or 6 at the time. And I said, what's with this lady? What's wrong with her? Why is she like this? She's so different from everybody else. There's obviously a problem. What's wrong? And my sister said, she's the drug addict. She's homeless. And that was probably my first encounter with a homeless addicted person. And I looked at that lady and I said, oh, in dread. Oh, no, that's going to be me. I said that. Why would I say that? I don't know. I didn't want it to be me. But I just, something made me say that, and I truly believe in manifestation, not as a Christian value, but as a witchcraft value, because I said those words as a very small child, not knowing what I was saying, but I spoke into existence before I realized in my addiction that I didn't want to go there, and I didn't have to. So soon after my bypass, I really, you know, you can't eat food anymore. You're obsessed with food, so, you know, you're thinking about food, but, you know, your addiction goes to something else. So when this girl introduced me to meth, the first time we inhaled it, and I was immediately hooked. I mean, I was hooked. Within 3 months, I had a really good job with a very prominent insurance company in Century City. I worked across the street from the Century City Mall. I was making really good money in 2005 when I left there. I was making like 60 grand. I didn't have a college education. You know, I'd gotten there on my own accord by a headhunter. I was very proud of the person I was as a work person. I was a very responsible, very hard worker. And I worked my way up everywhere I went. So I was proud of that. And
easier to do back then than now.
I'm sorry?
Back then you could work your way up. Back then you could work your way up. And now everybody wants a degree. You know,
oh, now you can't. You have to have a degree to work at Starbucks, I think.
Yeah, exactly.
So I don't even know if I ever had to. If I ever had to re-enter the workforce, I would have to read. And, you know, right now it's just taking care of myself and staying stable. So when I did get on meth, it was very quick. I was in a relationship with someone, and at the time I had met my husband, and he was dealing me marijuana too. So I was in a relationship, so he didn't want to touch that. He's got a lot of good characteristics and qualities, and that is not something he would touch, you know. So at the time we met, it didn't go. But a few months later, we hooked up again, and I was kind of ending my relationship with the person I was with at the time. And he said, you know, if you end it, we can be together. So I did that, and we quickly started dating, and, you know, and I'm also later have been diagnosed as borderline personality disorder. So, like, within 2 weeks, I had moved in. I never let go of my apartment until we were assuredly getting married. But when I, you know, when I had the ring on my finger and plans were being made, then I did let go of my apartment just before the wedding. I, you know, meeting my husband, I knew he wasn't into people who did meth because I knew he was seeing a girl who did meth, but he didn't really like her or want to get any closer to her because of that. So I told him, hey, you know, I do meth. You know, if you're not into it, you might not want to see me, which I can't believe I said that. You know, how crazy. But he's like, no, it's okay. You know, we did it for a while together, but then it got serious. missing work. I, you know, they finally brought me and found me asleep at my desk, and they said, what's going on? You know, I said, I lied. I said, I have a lot of medical issues, So I tried to get them to not fire me, which they didn't. They gave me another chance, and my doctor put me out on disability. He said, you're not able to work. You need to take care of this addiction. So that's what I did for the next 16, 17, I don't know how many years it's been, but I started going to treatment centers, and I went to Acton, I went to Dia Bonson, I went to Cordana, I went to Out Here Prototypes a couple times, I went to New Start for Moms, which is an outpatient, I've been to Vista Del Mar, I've been to all the hospitals in the valley, you know, just I went through all that, and I just really struggled because I didn't want to quit. It was being forced on me to quit. I knew I had a big problem, but I was going to handle it. You know, I was just going to write it out and see how it goes. Now, my husband was starting to insist, hey, I'm going to quit. We're going to quit. So I was like, okay, you know, and I'd always try, but it would never work out for me. I couldn't do it. It was just, I was already cold, and I, you know, I was hooked. I was really hooked. And, you know, I was for $20 a day so I could get my drugs, you know, and he would give me $20 a day, and when he couldn't, you know, he didn't, you know, and then I just didn't use. And then, you know, I was just failing and failing and failing at getting clean. And when we got married, you know, I even left him and said, you know, I don't want to get married. I don't want you to marry me. I'm a mess. You know, I'm gonna be terrible for you. And he's like, no, we're getting married. You know, he was just wonderful, you know, and he took care of me. And he, you know, if it weren't for my husband, I don't know where I'd be. And I'm God. You know, my husband is to me, he's my caretaker on this earth. And you know, God is, of course, my caretaker of my soul. But my husband's been so wonderful to me. You know, he has his own things, but I'm so lucky to have him. We had a baby 3 months after we got married. We got pregnant. I wasn't supposed to have children. I had told him, you know, if you want children, don't marry me because I'm infertile. And he's like, no, we'll see, you know, whatever. If we do, we do. And if we don't, we don't. But, yes, I wanted a child very bad, and God blessed me with a child after being diagnosed infertile. And, you know, I had this baby, and I was miserable during the pregnancy, but I was so happy to have her. I mean, I was very grateful. I didn't know how to live in gratitude. I didn't know how to live like that. You know, I was grateful. I would say I was grateful, but I couldn't show it. I was so depressed. I was so, you know, after I had my baby, I had to go right back on my meds. I couldn't breastfeed. I have severe disabilities, mental health disabilities, and, you know, I have to take the meds all the time. But there are times I don't, you know. But we had a baby, and I didn't use throughout my whole pregnancy. That was never an issue for me, thank God. But when she was 18 months old, I had started using again. And the same girl that introduced me to my husband, that got me, you know, introduced me to meth, she called social services, or what do they call it, CPS on me. And they did, they came, CPS came and to follow up. And I told them everything. I told them everything. I was completely 100% honest. They did me over, you know, like, they said I was an alcoholic. They said I was a drink. You know, I wasn't really a drinker at this point, you know, but I guess they grouped it into one. And they said I was neglecting my baby. And they said I was, you know, but, you know, I knew my baby was always fed. My baby was always loved. My baby was always with me. That I was endangering her, you know, because I'd have people come over and I would get high. So I didn't know any of this was wrong. I had never had any experience with CPS. It was a horrible situation. I remember telling the woman, I hope you go to hell, you know. And I was extremely traumatized that I was losing my child. But yet I knew it was imminent and it was coming, and I had been waiting for it because I knew how bad I was. And it was just, it was really sad, you know. We got our our custody of our daughter taken away from us when she was 18 months old. They were very gracious to me and said, you need to, you know, they weren't easy about explaining it. I had to kind of do everything and jump through all the hoops on my own and understand everything on my own. But they said, you know, go to treatment. You know, you'll get, and we'll work with you. So, you know, if I'd have known at that time all I had to do was go to treatment, shut up, and do what they wanted me to do, I would have been fine. But, no, I stressed over everything. But I went to a 10-month treatment inpatient facility in Pacoima, and they tell you when you go to treatment, you know, only 5% of you are going to make it. You know, I was like, I'm the one, I'm, you know, and everybody thought every time I go to treatment, you know, I'm the role model, you know, I'm the role model resident, but I get out and I lose it, you know. So I've had a really hard time achieving long-term sobriety, but I've had 3 years. I've had a year a couple times. I had a year where I did no meth, but I used marijuana. When we moved here, I had my son, and when I had my son, I didn't use, and I thought I was cured, and then 3 months after having my son, you know, I wanted to, you know, my husband worked a lot, so I was bored. I was lonely. I didn't have, I'm on disability, you know, I don't know what to do with myself. I don't know structure. I don't know, you know, if I wanted to sit in bed till 4, I did. If I wanted to get up at 9, I did. You know, I just did always since I was on survival mode, and I just wanted to be left alone by the authorities or my parents or, you know, my family. I just tried to do what I had to do so nobody would tell me anything because I didn't want to be told anything. And, you know, living on my own, I was able to do what I wanted to do. But now I was with this husband, and I didn't know how to be a wife, and I didn't know how to compromise, and I didn't know how to listen. I mean, I'm just learning this year how to follow direction, because like everybody, I don't like to be told what to do, but I mean, I see so many people in recovery that are so willing to follow direction. I wish, you know, and pray for that, because I'm just so not that way, but I'm learning. And that's the gift of recovery, is that I'm learning, you know. I've always wanted to do well and not, you know, be so promiscuous or not do drugs or not smoke or not drink or not be rude or mean or nasty or whatever. But, you know, I knew I was, you know, I felt I was different. Like I couldn't do the will of anybody else. I had to do my will. I was really running myself on self-will. And that self-will, you know, it got me through a lot of good jobs, and it got me, you know, to where I could support myself for a while, and I did really well for a long time, like about 15 years I worked and lived on my own, and then when, you know, kind of when I met my husband, everything went downhill. Unfortunately, not saying it's anybody's fault, but that's when I had the drug problem. So just since 2005, I've been in and out of recovery homes, sober living, treatment centers, and all that. And like I said, I did have some success, and that's good. You know, what I've learned, nobody can take away from me. But when my son was born, you know, and I went back to drugs, that's when I started stepping out in my marriage, because my husband said, enough, I'm not giving you money, I'm not enabling you. Well, then I took it upon myself to say, well, I'm going to pay for my drugs with what they're asking me to pay for, you know, which is, you know, sex. And I kind of became like a prostitute in my own home, you know, where I was seeing, you know, I tried to see someone on a regular basis so it wouldn't be so, you know, I wouldn't be running around with so many people. You know, I didn't want to get diseases or anything. I wanted to be with just one person. But it doesn't work out like that, you know. That's not how the drug life is, you know. It's crazy out there. It's a different lifestyle, and you know, you find yourself demoralizing every aspect of yourself to just get your drugs. And I do want to get to where I lost my children again for the second time from CPS. My husband had come home from working a long day, driving 2 hours from Santa Monica to Oxnard. He gets home. He didn't call me like he always does, but he comes home early, he catches me. I had a pipe in my hand. My friends were there. We were getting high, and he gets my phone, and we started fighting, you know, in front of my daughter, and my son's a little baby, so I don't know how it affected him at that point, but, you know, he wasn't making any fusses at the time, but my daughter was, you know, my husband and I were fighting in front of her because he sees that I'm talking to other men and what I'm doing and doing drugs, and he's livid, he's disappointed, he's heartbroken, and we're fighting, and me with my mental health issues, I don't know how to express anger, so I hit, and I push, and I, you know, scream and yell, and you know, I get a little out there. So we got a little physical, and I pushed him, and he pushed me, and my daughter was screaming, and we were on the phone with my sister, and she called the police, and they came, and they made the decision to kick in. And this time, because it was our second CPS case and it had not been like a certain amount of time, they were going to adopt the kids out. And I don't know, I had some holy water. And I know a lot of people don't believe in holy water, you know, but I just at the time I put it on my face. And 5 minutes later they called and they said, because you're doing everything, you're going to treatment, you're going to domestic violence, you're seeking out all the services, you don't have a right to your child, but your child has a right to you because you're trying. So they decided not to adopt our children out and give us another chance. So, I mean, just all these chances I've had, you know, just God, you know, protecting me and being with me. I don't know if they lost the paper or what, but we were just so blessed to get that opportunity. And even though my children are at stake, it's been really hard to stay away from drugs. You know, I realize I'm a very lonely person, and I'm also very social, but I'm also kind of introverted in a way where I need to decompress. I need alone time. I need to recompose myself. But in that, I get very lonely. So while I'm kind of distancing myself from everybody, I'm also like, hey, I'm all alone. I need, you know, excitement. I need drama. I need something, you know, and I would stir things up. So for me, that was a pattern that I would see, is that I would get clean for a while, and then I would get bored, and then I would be like, I don't know what to do. You know, I don't know what to do with myself. I don't have structure. You know, I tried to be a mother. It does not come naturally. Everything I am as a mother today, and my daughter tells me I'm a good mom, and my son, he shows me, you know, of course I can always be better. You know, I'm my biggest critic, and I sometimes think I'm not a great mother, but, you know, my daughter tells me I am, and just the love we have in our family, I know I'm doing something right. So my husband and I, even after all the cheating I did and to get my drugs, you know, he says to me, he goes, I know you were doing it because you wanted to get the drugs. I know you're not doing it because you love them, or, you know, which is really hard for someone to kind of come up with on their own. But he did. He kind of understands me so well. But, you know, in a way, it's enabling too, you know. Because I knew at some point, I knew, like, he's not going to leave me, you know, he's just going to put up with this, you know, but I have to be my own accountability and say, you know, this is not what I want to do. And that's been really hard, is to be accountable to myself, for myself, and not do, you know, like it says in the Bible, you know, we sin even though we don't want to. And it's like that. You know, I was doing terrible things even though I didn't want to, and I just knew, like, something was wrong with me. It wasn't the drugs, you know, because the drugs would go away for a while, and then I would want drugs again. But it wasn't that I was so addicted. You know, I would get 6 months or 9 months or whatever, you know. So it wasn't like I was having feelings of it, and I wasn't surrounding myself with people by it. So I would be called to go call someone, you know, because I was going through this pattern of picking up and stopping and picking up and stopping. So it's been trying to realize what's wrong with me and how do I respond to it, and you know, my diagnosis and how do I respond to that, and taking my medication and finding the 12-step program. You know, I had a little bit of OA before I had NA and AA, and I knew a little bit about the 12-step program when I came into it in 2005, and I hated the meetings. I couldn't stand going to meetings. I hated meetings. I don't know why. I didn't like them. I have ADD. I can't sit through them. I didn't like listening to people. It made me think about drugs. You know, I just wasn't ready, I don't think. And I think that you just have to get to a point where you're ready to say enough is enough. I'm going to give this an earnest try. I'm going to, you know, come hell or high water, I'm going to do my best. And if I fall, I'll get up, you know. And that's just really what I promised my husband is I can't promise. You know, before I was like, I can't promise a long-term sobriety or that I'll stop forever, you know, but I'm trying my best. And I promise you that as long as I'm alive, if I don't die from this, I'm going to keep trying. I'm going to keep getting up and trying. I promise you that. And that's the promise that I can keep, and I am keeping. I have 15 months now, clean and sober, no mind-altering substances except my medication, you know, that I prescribe, you know, but that's for my mental health, and it's not anything that's going to change my perception of life, you know, but I'm really happy today. There was a time where I didn't love myself, and I needed to learn to love myself, not selfishly, but, like, to know, like, this is how I respect myself and how I will ask people to respect me, to set boundaries. You know, I had no boundaries. Every man that ever asked me to have sex, you know, I didn't know how to say no. I just figured, okay, well, I know he doesn't love me, but he wants me, so this is good. No, you know, negative attention is attention. And for a long time, it was good enough for me. And then coming into recovery, you know, I realized, you know, it's quality over quantity of friends, you know, quality relationship, you know. Thank God, you know, it's because I think that I insisted when my husband and I got married that we have God in our marriage, that our marriage has lasted, because the amount of cheating that I did was just terrible, you know. I did so much to my husband, to my family, you know, my immediate family, you know, the family that we created. It's awful, and I feel terrible, but I'm learning to live with that and make the living amends, even though I'm not there or on my steps. But, you know, I will make this, my recovery is my living amends to my kids and my husband, because we've been through hell. You know, my kids, every time I had to go to treatment, my daughter was abandoned. You know, she doesn't have the capability to understand mommy's sick. Mommy is fighting addiction. You know, she doesn't know all that. You know, she just knows my mom's gone again, you know. So she's suffered a lot of trauma in her little life, you know, and she has pain now. She has, like, and I'm thinking, oh, my God, did I cause her pain from the trauma, you know. And we as parents, we all make mistakes. But it's about, I think, like, now we have a therapist, a family therapist that my husband and I see for marriage counseling, and my daughter sees for her trauma. And we check in as a family all the time. And if things go a little awry at the house, we bring it to our therapist, and she helps us work on it. She doesn't turn us into CPA, you know. She's like, that's not right. You cannot do that. You know, you cannot yell, or you have to be calm, or, you know, you have to try to do this, or, you know, she's teaching us to parent, and we're all learning this together, and it's unfortunate. It has also increased the bond in my family. We are so bonded, and we just love each other and support each other. So do you have questions?
Your husband. Yeah, your husband sounds like a really neat guy, so I'm glad that you found somebody that's sticking by you and and helping you through all of
I
your trials. Because we all need that.
I'm very blessed.
Yeah.
But I hope that I've given him as much as he gives to me, you know, and we support each other, you know. We're, like I said, we're very bonded. We all love each other very much, and we're very committed to each other. And he could have left, you know. He had to throw me out of the house once because I was using, and I had a guy I was bringing around the house, and, you know, and it was just not good, you know, if we're trying to, you know, not have a CPS case, and here I am doing all this stuff, you know, and it's easy to say I'm going to stop, but it's not easy to do, and it's just taken me a really long time, but, you know, every day I have is a miracle. I do want to live now as long as God will have me here, you know, but I feel that God has a calling for me. I don't know what it is. Because I don't really have any talents, you know, and disabled woman with children, you know. But
no,
I am a good communicator. I mastered being honest, you know. I told my probation officer, you know, that I didn't have the clean date I had, and I was just about to graduate, you know, and I told on myself, you know, and she'd never seen anything like that, you know, and people thought I was just absolutely crazy. You know, what are you doing? You're about to get off probation. So I was about to get off probation, and I had to tell my probation officer, I don't think I'm ready because I've got secrets. And I came clean to her. And they put me on probation for a month longer and tested me every day, and then they set me free. I couldn't believe it. I was like, what? You know, I've just been so blessed in my life, and I've always had good people to support me. I think that's the key, that people need good people to support them, you know, listen to them, hear them, hear their struggle, sympathize with them. And now I'm working with Tanya, who was on your show. You know, we're really good friends. We work together, and we kind of keep each other accountable. And we have similar stories as far as the sexual thing going on. But, you know, I have so many friends in recovery, and I have, you know, my mental health clinic that, you know, they do groups. I'm taking dialectical behavioral therapy as one of my groups. The other group I take is CTBAT, which is for trauma.
This is where I tell you that we're run out of time in the show, and you'll be shocked, but there's no more time. We have less than, we have about 6 minutes left, okay? So
okay.
What I want to do is I want to give everybody a chance to say thank you, which I'm doing now. And there's a couple other people here, too, and then, of course, our host tonight. But I just want to say, you know, several of the things you've said in the last few minutes are about being a service, how you keep looking for ways to be a service. And of course, one of them is participating at NASCA, which you've already identified as a possibility. And we certainly want you. You know, you have a lot to offer. And you are a good communicator, and that's all it needs to be to be helpful at NASCA. So I want you to know you have a lot going on for you, and, you know, we're very grateful that you showed up tonight and told your complete story. So thank you very much. And let me ask.
I'm so honored to be here, and I thank you so much. This is a great blessing, and if I can help anybody, you know, who is struggling, you know, just to know, don't quit. If you have life in you, don't quit. That's the main message.
Don't quit. Keep going. Right.
Don't quit.
So let me give it to Kim so she can go to the other couple of people that are here in the last few minutes. Kim,
okay.
you got the ball.
Okay. Thanks, Bill. Okay, well, Lane, did you have anything else that you would like to say before we wrap it up here? You got about maybe 1 minute.
Who, me? Me?
Lane.
Me?
I was going to say, did I have anything
else? Okay, well, I will just say, like today I am working on my stats. I'm I have a sponsor, you know, I have a sponsor, I have a, you know, recovery family. As soon as I get off the phone with you, I'm heading to a meeting, which is my home group, and I love recovery. I love that I get to be a mother. I love that I get to be alive and grateful for life today. And my heart's desire, and I think that it's God's will too, is to help other people either get off the street, get out of prostitution, get out of addiction, or whatever. It just be of service in any way I can.
That's great. Well, we appreciate that. We appreciate you. And it has been fun so fast. But just thank you again for honoring us with your story. And you are a part of the NASCA family now. So as Bill was saying,
thank you so much.
If you want to plug into, you are welcome. You can call in any time onto the guest line that that I have said at the beginning of the show. It's 646-595-2118. And so anytime, you are welcome to just call in, and you can be a part of the panel and ask questions, or you can just listen on. So we just
awesome.
Are so
Thank
glad
you
that you're on.
So much.
So let me
Thank
ask
you.
Annie, did you have anything else you wanted to say, Annie, before we get going?
Well, I wanted to say thank you to Nadine, and I wanted to say I really identified with some of the chunks of your life that you told about, so you're not alone. I've been there too. Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Thank you, Annie. God bless you all.
Yeah. Well, bless you too, and I know that there is something wonderful out there for you that you're going to plug into real soon. I just know it. I can tell. But I look forward to just connecting and kind of doing a little bit of life with you. I sent you a Facebook friend request. So
okay.
Yeah, I'd love to just connect with you in that way. And I'm sure that now that you've been on the show, you'll probably get more requests from people that are on NASCA. So we'll just
awesome.
Want to bring you into the family and make you feel welcome. So again,
yeah, if I can do anything, I always try to offer a kind word or encouragement, or, you know, I just try to be a very positive person, and I'm also very real, you know, I'm not going to lie to people, but, you know, I try to keep the silver lining, the golden lining, or whatever it is, but, you know, try to give, I'm a firm believer in neuroplasticity, you know, thinking good thoughts, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that there could be a lot more peace going on in the world if we all were thinking good thoughts.
Yeah.
I do, too. You know, Nadine, we all recognize the kind of an attitude that you have about your recovery that we admire. And other people will hear that same thing in your voice because we hear, you know, we hear many people tell their stories. And we can tell you're grateful that you've gotten where you are, but you don't take it for granted. And that's really another important message for people out there that are listening, you know, that you can't take this for granted. It's only a few of us in comparison to the group that don't get it, do get it, that recovery is possible and we commit ourselves to it. And, you know, there's a lot of work for us to do. So you have a lot to offer, and you can always offer it through NASCA. I think the idea of calling in on some other shows using the same number that you did tonight is a great one because it'll just get you, you know, comfortable with hearing other people, and also, you know, you're not going to be pressed to tell your whole story again, okay, not for a while. But we appreciate what you've done tonight, and I want to thank you and Wayne very much.
I thank you guys so much, too, and I'm trying to not only be grateful, but to live in gratitude. And you know, they say that the program is a program of action. So my choices, I have to make very carefully today. And it's about recognizing that I have a choice and what that choice could be.
All right. Now we're out of time. So let's let Kim close the show with a little music and we'll get out of here. How's that?
Okay. Thanks so much, everyone.
You all
have a good night. Take care.
Good night.
Another tomorrow. 'Cause that dawn was